From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. I am thrilled to welcome Marcia Clark back to the show. Marcia Clark rose to national prominence when she had her own TV show that aired every single day for a year. The show was called The O.J. Simpson Trial. In addition to her work as a prosecutor, Marcia Clark has written several books, including a great memoir and several nifty thrillers. Some of them feature a prosecutor called Rachel Knight, and some of them feature a defense attorney called Samantha Brinkman, and all of them are great. And now Marcia Clark has written a true crime story. It is called Trial by Ambush, Murder, Injustice, and the Truth About the Case of Barbara Graham. And you can read it right after the show. Marcia Clark, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Gary, thanks for having me. Nice to talk to you again.
It's so good. It's been a few years since we've talked, and lots of things have happened to us all in that time.
Yeah.
And one of those things was that O.J. Simpson passed away. And I wondered, the day that I heard that, I thought of you immediately and sent a note to your publicist. I don't know if she got it to you, but I was wondering, you know, what were your thoughts that day?
I mean, I didn't have many. People were asking me for comment, and I thought, well, the only person that's going to hear my comment is his family. They don't deserve anything that I felt about him. And so I sent my condolences, which failed to give them the clickbait they wanted. But it was genuinely how I felt. Sorry for them that they lost a beloved relative. I think they did remain fairly close. Then again, I always got along with his family. You know, I mean, we ran into each other again in the courtroom in Las Vegas during the trial there. And it was a very cordial encounter. You know,
it's always a whole separate thing. And why were you there for that? I mean, someone, did they call you or for some reason?
In Las Vegas?
Yeah.
I was covering the case in Las Vegas for that hard-hitting news agency, Entertainment Tonight.
Oh, yes. I had a guest on my show not too long ago, Melody Thomas Scott, and she is the star of The Young and the Restless, which is a soap opera.
Yeah.
And she told me that, you know, soap operas were flourishing in the 90s and had been since the 1920s, I guess. And she said that when the O.J. trial was on every day, they watched it every day. There, you know, everybody is watching it. And people stopped watching the soaps. And she said the soaps never really recovered. When the O.J. Simpson trial ended, people went to, you know, that's kind of when 24-hour news, you know, became the thing. And people stopped watching the soaps and they almost all went away, except for The Young and the Restless.
Gary, I have to tell you about one of the more harrowing moments after the trial that I had to, they had me appear before SAG-AFTRA. SAG and AFTRA had merged. They were the ones that's the union that represents actors. And of course, in the audience was a plethora of soap opera stars and actors. And my first words out of my mouth were, I looked at them out there. I could feel the fangs being bared. And I said, it's not my fault. I believe me, guys, I would have been very happy if they'd gone away and watched you. I never wanted this. Please don't hold it against me. Because it was true. When you went in your intro, when you said Marcia had a show, you know, that it was on every day.
Yeah.
People actually came up to me after the trial was over and said, I miss your show. I miss your show.
Do people
have lost?
Did people ask you for your autograph then? I mean, imagine they do now because you're on TV and you're a TV personality. But then, did people say, "Can I have your autograph"?
More so, and that was the craziest thing of all. You know, I mean, people started coming up to me to ask my autograph. I at first was like, "Why? You know, why are you doing this?" Eventually, I learned not to argue with them.
Just sign. Did they ask you to sign strange things, like sign this newspaper or magazine, or did they just want another piece?
They just asked me to sign everything. Baseballs. Some one guy. Yeah, one guy asked me to sign his head. You know. I mean.
That's great. Well, L.A. Right.
Yep.
And one of the things I love about your new book, which is called Trial by Ambush, Murder, Injustice, and the Truth About the Case of Barbara Graham, is that you are in it. You know, you're on every page. I mean, you wrote it, just like all of your books that I love. But occasionally you are present in it, and you talk about yourself and your cases. And at one time you talked about the newspapers that used to line the streets. And, you know, it's, you know, these, ladies and gentlemen, there used to be a thing called newspapers. They were great. And you talked about what it was like for those people in the 50s to sort of see the headlines, the jurors to see the headlines as they walked into court. And then you said that it was you too, that you also would see the headlines when you were working there.
Yeah, back then, I mean, and through the 90s, and I don't even know when it ended because it did. I don't see them anymore. But there used to be these glass cases. You drop in the coin and you can buy the newspaper. But in order to get people to drop that coin, they would put these bold type ginormous headlines on the front page, right? But above the fold, as they say, so that, and then those cases actually lined the street in front of the Hall of Justice where Barbara's courtroom was. So the jurors had been instructed, as they are today, in no uncertain terms, not to see, not to watch TV, not to listen to the radio, don't get your, you know, any information about this case other than from the courtroom and the testimony on the witness stand. But it's really hard to avoid, harder today than it was then. But still, those jurors walk out of the courtroom and bang, we're confronted with all of these glass cases with big headlines about the trial. And they were putting out newspapers about her case morning, afternoon, and evening because they didn't have the internet. And so their way of doing 24/7 news coverage is to put it in all three editions of the paper. And the jurors couldn't, I don't know how they missed it. I don't think they did.
Right.
So, yeah. And that did continue through the Simpson trial. And at some point that kind of petered out, but, you know, newspapers are no longer the source that they once were.
Well, one thing that I know about you, because I read all your books, is that you, as a prosecutor, I don't know how many cases you prosecuted, but there were a lot of them, and your record is a lot and one. I mean, you only lost one. Isn't that right?
Two.
Two.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Two one. Out of hundreds. It's
yeah.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of them being that television one.
Yeah.
And so, you know, oftentimes in your new book, you kind of make reference to that. But you were also a public defender, right?
I was a private practice, and that's where I started, in private practice as in defense work, as a criminal defense attorney. And then after I left the DA's office, I wrote books for a while, did television for a while, and then wound up doing court-appointed appeals for the indigent. So I handle criminal appeals in California, I think in most states. Maybe all states. Once you've been convicted of a felony, you're entitled to a direct appeal paid for by the state, in which lawyers like me are appointed by the Court of Appeal to represent you in your direct appeal of your conviction.
So you're still doing that now.
And I'm still doing that now. Yeah. I thought, you know, I wanted to keep my hand in. It kind of felt like a shame, you know, to walk away. I love the practice of law. I love being a criminal attorney. So I loved it on both sides. I love being a defense attorney. I love being a prosecutor. And this is really, I have to say, it's wonderful to do appellate work because it is really kind of the pure practice of law. You're not in there spinning and doing razzle dazzle. You're not in the courtroom with the jurors. You are just really focused on the evidence and the law and how the two come together, the application of one to the other. And you're appealing to justices who are very, very well versed in the law, as well as all the appellate lawyers. I like to say that this is my chance to hang out with the smart kids because they're like the most knowledgeable when it comes to the law. And it's really a pleasure to be in this kind of company.
Well, I want to follow up on all of that, but I want to start by asking you this question. So when you wrote this book, Trial by Ambush, you're taking a case that happened in the 1950s and you're examining it from both sides and kind of armchair quarterbacking everything that transpired. And I remember having a conversation with you before about Vincent Bugliosi's book, Outrage, The Five Reasons Why O.J. Simpson Got Away with Murder. And Bugliosi was a guest on my program several times, and he's no longer on Earth. But you told me then that you thought that that book was unfair or stupid or whatever you said, because, you know, this this person is armchair quarterbacking without having been there and doesn't understand what was going on. This was before, I want to say, before the television series that let everybody in the world know your point of view that based on the book that you wrote, which made perfect sense. But so how is what you're doing different than what Vincent Bugliosi did?
What Vincent Bugliosi did was actually just more ignorant than it was anything else. The things that he was saying should have been done were absurd. Number one thing, the first mistake was in saying that as the prosecutor, you are the director of the film. You're the director of the movie. You are absolutely not. You are just another player in the field, on the battlefield. The judge is the director. And the judge gets to say sustained or overruled or move on, counsel. You don't get to do that at all. So that misconception shows me how little he remembered of trial practice. On top of that, he was also advocating a really foul, despicable argument that I should have made to the jury, according to him, in which I should have pointed out to this jury that Mr. Simpson would qualify as a house N-word and not a field N-word, and therefore that they should not feel sympathetic toward him because he was the kind of N-word that they could never have been. It was so disgusting and it was so offensive to me that I thought, how does anyone make this argument? How does anyone say these words? Are you crazy? So, yeah, I was offended by it in terms of not. I'm always up for critique. I'm up for notes. Give me notes. I really am. And so I have to say, it was so ill-considered and so ill-informed, and it really struck me as someone who is so out of touch that he had no idea what I was confronted with in terms of the society's viewpoint at the time, the fact that we had just been through the Rodney King riots, the jury that was likely to be affected by that verdict, acquitting the officers of beating Rodney King. There was so much going on then. And to say the things that he did was like, you're making all prosecutors look bad with this. This is terrible. And if you would really do these things, then I'm glad you're not in the courtroom anymore, because it was offensive to everyone. So it's one thing to do a rational critique and say, well, you should have argued this more or put more emphasis on that or whatever. Fine. We had reasons for doing everything we did. We thought about it carefully. Nothing was ill-considered. Or let me put it this way. Nothing was not considered. It was not as though we overlooked things. We had choices to make. We made them. They were informed decisions. I largely stand by them. There were some mistakes, of course. I would say there were mistakes on a daily basis, because there always are. Because in the thrust and parry of battle in a courtroom, you have a decision to make with every second. Every second. Should I object? Should I not object? You know, and in the course of making these snap judgments and snap decisions, some mistakes will be made.
Well, you know, I'm very thin-skinned, and I can't tolerate any criticism of any kind. In fact, this summer a woman said to me, you look like you've put on weight, and I haven't eaten solid food since. But I guess in your position, especially after the OJ trial, you had to really have a thick skin, because there was so much criticism.
There was. And that was fine. I think dissenting voices are a good thing. And that's why, looking back at Barber's trial, I tried to put it in context as much as possible. There was certainly a different feeling about what a prosecutor's job was back then, even though the courts were saying it's a prosecutor's job to ensure the right of a fair trial, to ensure that a defendant gets the discovery to which he's entitled, to ensure that you are never pushing the envelope to the point where you're going after someone unfairly. All of that was on the books back then. And I quoted from those cases, some of which dated back to the 1800s. So those statements were on the books. Nevertheless, I think there was an attitude, kind of a cowboy attitude, in the DA's office that you go get them, and you put the notch in your belt and you get them any way you can, fairly or unfairly. And I found many, many reasons to find that it was unfairly done. And so my criticisms about how the case was handled were more bright line. It wasn't just, oh, I think you should have made this argument or that argument, although some arguments were definitely personally demeaning and horrifying on a very personal gendered level that was really offensive and unnecessary. And instead of arguing the law and the facts, and J. Miller Levy got up and argued that, gentlemen, she's a pretty girl and you're going to turn your heads and she's going to try and turn your heads. And that's all she was trying to do was seduce you. And I mean, this is horrible stuff and patently untrue from what I saw. So, but all of that paled compared to the way they hid critical evidence, exculpatory statement that would have helped Barbara enormously to show that the accomplice who was a star witness was a liar, hid another witness who would have established that the way in which they lured her into suborning perjury from an undercover cop was just an act of desperation and born of the pressure put on her by a police agent in jail, a woman who was acting for the police. And then they hid that woman so that the defense could never call her and put her on the witness stand. So I'm talking about bright line misconduct. I'm not talking about, you know, you could have been a better lawyer. I'm talking about you could have been an honorable lawyer, which I consider to be quite different than what Bugliosi was saying.
Well, I can see that a defense attorney could find themselves frequently in a case where they are defending someone that they believe is guilty, but it's their job mm-hmm. to give them the best defense they can do. But do you think that there are, and you can speak firsthand since you were a prosecutor, do prosecutors prosecute people they know are not guilty because they want to win a case?
Not in my experience, ever, never. It should never, never happen. If you have any doubt, and I don't even mean reasonable doubt, I mean any doubt that you're prosecuting somebody who isn't guilty of exactly what they've been charged with, then you ought not to be in court, period, period. And I have dismissed cases where I initially did believe the defendant was guilty or guilty of a certain kind of crime, and then dismissed because I just didn't believe it. Usually there are enough checks and balances before you get to trial that this does not happen. You're not even in front of a jury before you realize that it's not there. So you have the initial filing stage, you have pretrial motions, you have a preliminary hearing, you have discovery, you have all kinds of, the investigation is ongoing. By the time you get to putting 12 in the box, as they say, you've had many opportunities to look at the evidence very carefully. There is one exception to that, and it happened to me when I was handling misdemeanors as a prosecutor. In that situation, and this was a case in Beverly Hills. Back then, Beverly Hills still had a seedy hotel or two on its fringes, on the outlier perimeters of the boundaries. And this was a malicious mischief charge of somebody who had apparently thrown something through a glass window in the course of an argument. And we did not have preliminary hearings for misdemeanors. And somebody else did the filing. One filing deputy would handle it. And then they would hand the case to us literally in the courtroom as we're picking a jury. So there was no way to know what you were going to have in the way of evidence. By the time we got to the end of the people's case and then they put on the defense, it was maybe one witness, I saw that it wasn't there. And I said, this is not right. This person did not do this. I just don't believe it. And I went to my boss. And I said, we have to dismiss. This is not right. This case isn't here. He said, no, this is a jury's call. You let them decide. I said, but it's not right. If I don't believe it, they shouldn't believe it. No, you go try the case. Finish the case. And I thought, well, so I can't dismiss, but I know what I can do. So I got up in closing argument. I said, I'm allowed to argue twice. I'm not going to because I don't believe this case is here. And I'm here to tell you that if I were you, I would acquit. I don't believe this. I don't believe the charge. I don't believe the witnesses. You cannot convict this person. And sat down and said, please listen to the defense attorney. They came back within 10 seconds and said, yes, not guilty. I said, thank you.
And were there repercussions from your boss about that?
And they acquitted. What can you do?
Yeah. Well.
You said let the jury decide, right?
So you helped them. Have you ever, other than that one, experienced pressure from above to prosecute a case that you didn't believe in?
No, I didn't. It was not long after that I wound up in felonies. And as I said, with felonies, there's so many opportunities to see what isn't right about the case before you get there. And if there was if it ever happened that it just didn't look like it was there, my bosses were very, and I had some great bosses, I have to admit. I was very lucky, very lucky. And I could go to them and say, I think this is not going to make it. And it wasn't really necessarily that this guy was absolutely innocent, didn't do it, or didn't do, more likely the case is usually a situation of didn't do what we charged, not that he's not the one. Eyewitness ID is now seldom an issue, especially with surveillance cameras everywhere and that sort of thing, DNA. But I never had a situation where they'd say, no, you take it anyway, go to trial, never.
Well, I want to ask you about the death penalty, because this case that you write about, Marsha Clark, in Trial by Ambush, Murder, Injustice, and the Truth About the Case of Barbara Graham, is a death penalty case. And they made a movie about it that many people might remember if they like cool old black and white jazzy movies.
Yeah.
Called I Want to Live.
I Want to Live.
Won the Academy Award for Susan Hayward for Best Actress, and directed by Robert Wise, who's a great director. So I think it's a really good film. I've always liked the movie. So in your book, you I can't remember how you said it exactly. I should have made a note. If I were an attorney, I would have written it down. That you didn't want to weigh in exactly on your opinion on the death penalty. So let me ask you, what is your opinion of the death penalty, Marsha Clark?
The problem I had, the reason I didn't weigh in on it there is that is a whole world of a subject by itself. There's a whole other book to be written. And someone has, Kathleen Karen, who was very helpful to me in guiding me towards the research sources that I needed for the book. She wrote about Barbara Graham, but in the context of the death penalty as administered to women. And it's a fascinating, great book. I highly recommend it, called Proof of Guilt. She went there and she did that. So I wanted to actually delve into the trial.
Right.
And she did not do that. So we are complementary to each. Our books are complementary and helpful. I have not had to consider that much because we have a moratorium here in California. The death penalty has really not been a force in at least 10 years, probably more, and may never be. Gary, we could talk about this for hours. I can't get there in just a couple minutes because there's so much pro and con about it.
Yeah.
Suffice it to say, at this time, with all that we know about DNA technology and the advancements in science and technology when it comes to criminal cases and the proof of guilt, it feels more and more like we should step back from anything as final as a death penalty at this point and stop spending our money on this, which is considerable, actually.
Yeah. It costs more, doesn't it, to have a death penalty case than to have a life in prison?
A lot more.
Yeah.
It costs a lot more, not a little bit, a great deal. Life without the possibility of parole is a pretty strong sentence. It means you're going to die in prison unless the law changes to some great degree. And in California, it actually is. We are in the process of refining the felony murder rule, which is, for those who are not nerds like me, the felony murder rule is a rule that says that when you commit a certain kind of violent felony, if a murder occurs, if a homicide occurs in the course of committing that felony, even if it's accidental, even if you didn't mean to, you're on the hook for murder. We used to scoop up everybody with that and sentence them to either life without or death. But now we're starting to refine our scope of culpability, and we are looking at whether or not you're an actual killer, whether or how you participated in the felony, et cetera. And we're doing a much more nuanced job of it, which I think is a good thing, because ultimately justice is served when a person is punished for what they did. The punishment should always fit the crime.
Well, let me ask you then, outside of the realm of law, just as from, my friend Marsha Clark, if you weren't involved in criminal activities, in the law, do you think that the death penalty is a reasonable punishment for the crime of murder or any crime?
I just feel like it's too, I don't know, Gary, I really don't want to go here because I have too much to say about this.
Okay.
It doesn't go in a satisfying direction because I kind of go back and forth and back and forth. For those victims who have suffered the loss of a loved one through murder, there is no pain like it. There is no way to describe what these survivors go through, and that they would want to see the person who did this to them. And it's not just one person. When a murder occurs, there's a ripple effect that really tears a hole in the life of so many who knew that person. It's not like losing someone to illness or even an accident. So I have to say, when they say, I want that person put to death, I get it. For the rest of us who have not suffered the loss, it's really easy for us to say, well, gee, aren't you worried about it not being fair or not being right? Or maybe there will be a change and we'll find out through DNA, blah, blah, blah. That's very easy for an armchair warrior to sit back and say who has not been affected by it. So my feelings about it are very mixed, and I can't, as you see, I bounce back and forth and back. And it's not satisfying, Gary. Let's move on.
Moving on to a certain extent, as a prosecutor, did you prosecute death penalty cases, and had the death penalty ever been applied to a case that you won?
I prosecuted death penalty cases. At this time, three of those I prosecuted are on death row. I firmly believe that they will outlive me.
Right, because that's the way it goes now, right? I mean, sometimes when you read about things in the past, like the case of Bruno Richard Hauptmann, the man accused of the Lindbergh kidnapping and murder.
Yes.
And he was executed, I think, about 20 minutes after they arrested him. I mean,
so fast.
It was very fast then.
Yeah. And so was Barber's case. I mean, that was amazing to me. Within 2 years of the guilty verdict, she was dead. That was quick. We do not do that anymore. Our cases linger for decades before anyone gets executed, if indeed, as I've said, if they ever do, right. Which I don't think they will, at least in California. In Texas, it's pretty fast there, too, certainly faster than here. But here is a high bar. That said, that's all the more reason. And as I was writing this book and looking at what the prosecution did, I do believe that had the prosecution not pulled the fast ones that they did, the ambush that they did, I do not think she would have been executed. I do not think they would have voted for the death penalty.
Well, you know, Marcia Clark, I've really enjoyed your thrillers, your Samantha Brinkman stories and Rachel Knight stories, and I hope there'll be more of them, or maybe you have a new character you're going to introduce. But what made you put aside fiction and tackle this true crime story?
You know, good question. I never thought I would, Gary. I really didn't. I thought I really enjoyed writing fiction so much, and I got accused of by Publishers Weekly when I first came out with the Rachel Knight series, saying Clark turns to fiction to control the outcome. And I thought, you know, they're right. They are certainly right about that.
Sure.
But then I had, it was one of these things where my agent had said, you know, you really ought to think about writing a true crime book, because it's a natural melding of my experience doing appellate work, especially, but more broadly, all of my work as a criminal lawyer. And then the ability to dissect someone else's case for a change and look at what happened. And it took a long time to even find the case. It just was kind of a dawning realization that this might be another thing to do that would be interesting. And it turned out to be fascinating. In this particular case, I didn't initially think it would be something I wanted to write about, because when I realized that it was such a famous case, it was its own crime of the century, trial of the century, that is. I thought, well, it's going to be covered from one end to the other. I don't want to go where everyone else has gone already. And then as I began to look into it, realized, no, they didn't. They didn't write about it. One book was written by a reporter who had covered the case for the Herald Examiner, I think it was, which was one of the more yellow tabloid journalistic efforts that really went after Barbara Hammer and Tong and was in lockstep with the prosecution. And sure enough, that reporter collaborated on the book he wrote with the lead prosecutor. So, so much for an unbiased view. And it wasn't an unbiased view at all. So the book was not terribly helpful, although he had some materials that no one else could get because the prosecutor gave them to him. And to the extent I could verify that they were for real, I used those materials, but I didn't use the book at all. And then there was the opportunity to actually get the trial transcripts. And that to me was the key thing. And I realized, and that was when I decided, as I read those transcripts, oh, there's a story and a half here. I'm not sure I can do it all in one book. Uh-huh. And that was really, there was just so much to it. Just all of the machinations and the twists and turns in the trial, which is why you understand as you read this, why it is the trial of the century. Spectators were lining the courthouse hallways every day to get a seat in the courtroom.
Well, and I imagine it was a lot more work than writing your own made-up story, because you had to go through all that stuff. But as you were looking at that, all that stuff, did you think, well, you know, why, this is a lot of work. Why am I going to do all this work? I could just write another novel.
But I wanted to do something different. Wanted to, you know, I myself was never a big true crime reader either.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you and I were talking about this before we started.
Yeah.
And you're saying you're not,
I don't
you're
like
not a
the
big
lurid
fan of it.
Nature or the, you know, the exploitive. I don't want to be, I don't want to be exploited by my interest in it. Does that make sense? Yeah.
It does totally to me. Totally. And I felt that way too. So I really didn't go there. And I felt like, look, as I was examining the cases that I had collected over the years that I might think, you know, could be a basis for something fictional.
Yeah.
I realized that they were all monsters in the closet. And as you say, lurid tales of gore and guts and blood. And so I'm not going to write about that. I don't care to read that personally. So of course we don't want to write what we don't want to read. And especially when it comes to true crime, I felt like there has got to be a deeper, more important reason to write this story, to write about this case. If I can't find big issues, big principles and ideas that are relevant to society, relevant to us from a criminal justice standpoint, then there's no point in doing it. And I don't just want to write a story that makes you go, you know, that makes you scared at night. Or makes you sick, or make, you know what I mean? That's what's the point of that?
Yeah.
It's one of those cheap thrill kind of things that is not my jam.
And there are, you know, there's one on television every night, so you don't have to write about it.
But, really?
But but it seemed to me when I was reading Trial by Ambush that there were a lot of elements to the story that pertain to our current political life, our situation in America today. And so I wonder if you saw those things and if you could elucidate them a little.
Yeah. And that was, to me, I think the primary motivator was I was reading these trial transcripts and then reading all of the, I gathered materials from all over the place, including newspaper clippings by the ton. They were not very reliable in terms of what the actual testimony was necessarily. Don't forget, they didn't have recordings. They didn't have cameras in the courtroom. They were scribbling as people were testifying. So some was good, some was not. But I certainly got a feeling for the social attitude, for society's attitude toward the case, toward Barbara in particular, their obsession with her looks, their obsession with her in general, the ways in which she was mistreated and misrepresented almost completely 180 from what she was. She was framed up as the mastermind. In a case where she was clearly not that. She was clearly nothing more than meant to be a lure to get the victim to open the door. So she went to the door, said, knock, knock, knock. My car broke down. Can you help me? She was a petite, pretty young woman. And the older woman who answered the door, who was the murder victim, would not feel threatened by her. And it was the only way the men knew that this woman would open the door. And that's all she was. So to stand her up as the mastermind and the centerpiece for the brutal murder of this woman was unbelievably wrong and unfair. And so I thought, but that happens today too. The press decides what your image should be of someone, characterizes them in a certain way, and then everybody runs toward that, you know, and you see that happening in social media as well as on television. How the press can shape a case and shape public opinion. Certainly that happens today. I think the benefit today is what's different today is that you have dissenting voices. You have people like you. You have people on Substack, people on Instagram. You have anywhere, all over the place, talking about their own point of view. It's a wonderful thing because people are not afraid today as much as they were then to fall out of line and say, no, I don't see it that way. But back then, all of the newspapers, and I mean every single one of them, lined up behind the other to say Barbara was a villainous and a seductress and an evil, stone-hearted killer. And no one thought to question testimony by the accomplice, John True, the ironically named John True, biggest liar you've ever seen. He was the state's whole case. No one thought to question testimony that was physically illogical, physically impossible to commit the way he said Barbara committed this murder. So it was remarkable that it took really a reporter at the very end of it all, Ed Montgomery, who worked for the San Francisco Examiner. He had been up in the city room up in the Bay Area, hadn't been in court, but he'd been filing all the stories along with all the rest of them saying Barbara was the villain. When he came down to the courtroom and began to watch the testimony, he changed and went 180 and said, this is so wrong. We've got this all wrong. And he became her champion. But by then it was so late. And by then no one was listening. Shortly thereafter, she was convicted and sentenced to death. So quickly, it made my head spin. That's a whole other issue. But I don't think it would be that way today. We still have the problem, though. The problem persists of public opinion being swayed by a few loud voices, and the press in particular, you know, can certainly push the narrative in its own direction. And unless somebody pushes back, that becomes the groupthink, and that becomes the narrative. And I do think we have to watch out for that today as well.
And the thing that's interesting now is that when we say the press, the press has very little sway, because the press, as we were alluding to earlier, has very little sway, because there's so many other it's very easy to live in a bubble in which you only get the feed that is of interest and agrees with you. So therefore, you see a certain truth that is, as a Marcia Clark, as a former prosecutor, how do you feel about the erosion of truth as a thing nowadays?
Drives me crazy. It literally drives me crazy. It's like, as you said, people have a tendency to sit within the bubble and make sure they get fed. It's confirmation bias over and over and over again, as you get fed constantly a diet of what you already believe. And you have to actually make a concerted effort, an affirmative push, to get outside that bubble and pull in other points of view. For this, I am very grateful to those podcasters and like yourself who are willing to step outside and say, okay, I don't see it that way. And it's enlightening. And I don't mean trolls. I don't mean people who just throw mud, you know, for the fun of it. They're useless. I'm talking about people who have reasoned opinions that differ from mine. And that's always enlightening, extremely helpful, and changes my mind routinely. And it's only when you get that kind of breadth of opinion that you can really get to what the truth is. Otherwise, all you're doing is confirming, or as we say, forgive me, buying your own bullshit over and over and over again. You know, that's not helpful. You're never going to get to the truth that way. So I am not down with alternative facts.
Alternative facts.
I just think that it is an erosion of the fabric of our society, that we can choose to believe what we want to believe and ignore the rest. That's a bad thing. And I'm really hoping we pull away from that and start paying attention to the other voices in the room.
I was a middle school teacher for like 28 years, and I retired from that 6 years ago. And I still occasionally will dream that I can't find my classroom, that my kids are being annoying, my principal wants to speak with me, these kinds of, you know, things that now are, I don't have to worry about them. They're long gone, but they still haunt my dreams. So I wonder about you. Do you still find yourself dreaming a prosecutor's nightmare?
No, finally, no. You know, Gary, it's been long enough. Thank goodness. I bet you were a great middle school teacher. I bet your kids loved you. Thanks. I mean, I would have loved to have a teacher like you, but, yeah, thank goodness I don't. And yet I feel like I kind of live with it, to be honest. You know, you made me think of this. Thanks for this, Gary. But I'm remembering what's happening now, because I do handle these cases on appeal. So the cool thing is, I take court-appointed cases from the entire state of California. And California is a much more diverse state than we get credit for. We're so deep blue. But there's actually, you know, areas of California that are very deep red. And so you get different kinds of verdicts, different kinds of prosecutors and defense attorneys throughout the state. And I get to see it on a daily basis. And so I actually had the nightmare of getting upset at the way cases are sometimes not fairly handled. The rulings don't come down as they should from the judge. The prosecutor doesn't do this, or the defense attorney doesn't do that. And I guess that's, I don't have to dream it because I see it when I'm awake. So thanks for reminding me of that.
My pleasure.
I was all set to say it's all behind me.
So armchair quarterbacking is really a difficult thing to get over, I would imagine.
Well, we are actually paid to be armchair quarterbacks. That's the job. It right. really is. We are error catchers. That's what we are. And so that's fine. And it's nothing personal. I mean, perfectly great judges can make mistakes, and perfectly great prosecutors and defense attorneys also. It's not a slam on their abilities. It's just that, especially from the distance of an appeal, it's kind of a cool thing. I stand back and look at the forest, whereas when you're in trial, you're in the middle of the trees. So when you can take those steps back and get that distance, you can see things, you know, from above, so to speak, that they couldn't see and didn't have a time to see or a chance to see. So it's a different perspective. And I think that's really wonderful. But I also feel like that was kind of writ large my experience of working on this book, because as I was reading the trial transcripts and seeing what the prosecutors did, and I'm talking about willful malfeasance. I'm not talking about, oh, you goofed. You know, I'm talking about saying things you shouldn't say, doing things you shouldn't do. And there were times that I had to stand up and go take a walk because I couldn't take it. It was just way too upsetting and frustrating to see the way justice was subverted.
How long did you work on Trial by Ambush, Murder, Injustice, and the Truth About the Case of Barbara Graham, Marcia Clark?
I would say the better part of 2 years. It does take a long time, like you said.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of work to do. It's the research, gathering the materials and stuff, and then you're reading and reading and reading. The trial transcript was over 4,000 pages. Clerk's transcript was 1,000, and then there were all the letters and things I amassed from the Hollywood producer that did the film, I Want to Live.
Yeah.
He created an archive of all of the papers and letters he amassed that were written by Barbara, her lawyers, or whatever, and those were a treasure trove as well, but it's a lot of reading.
He had some interesting, Walter Wanger had some interesting court cases himself. I mean, he had to go to court.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, he's an interesting character.
Yeah. And a great producer. Produced Stagecoach, among other great movies.
He did.
Yeah.
He did. And he was a death penalty abolitionist. That's why he made I Want to Live, because he was hoping to spark a public outcry against the death penalty. And it worked. There was a Senate bill as a result of the film that did get pushed through, but didn't actually pass.
I read once that Pat Brown, the former governor, said that he regretted allowing the execution of Carol Chessman in California, that was one of his great regrets.
Interesting. Because he didn't kill anyone.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that was really the bottom line, and I think that he was right about that. I mean, if you're going to have a death penalty, and as you know, that's a big if in my world. But if you are, then you really ought to have a bright line that's pretty bright and pretty big. And Pat Brown was actually somebody that they were trying to appeal to with Barbara's case, because the governor was actually a Republican, but Pat Brown was the AG, the attorney general, and he was Democrat, and they thought he would be sympathetic, and he was. But he ultimately was not able to help Barbara.
Well, I guess if you're elected by the people and you have to do then your job, then you can't allow your own personal opinions to interfere. But I guess I don't know how you would not. I don't know how that works.
Well, they do have the power of clemency. And when you have the power of clemency, then your personal feelings naturally come into play. So you're right. I mean, all of this is very tangled in the sense that if you don't want to have a law that is applied in an arbitrary manner, in a way that depends so much on someone's personal biases, then it doesn't seem that it could possibly be fair. You're going to like one person more than another. Is that fair? That's not fair. You have to judge based on what the evidence was and the nature of the crime itself, and then the nature of the person. So I don't know. That's a tough call, and I'm not running for office, and I'm not governor, and I'm not going to be governor, and it's okay with me.
Did you ever consider running for office?
You know how they say never say never?
Yes.
Yeah, I can say never. Never, 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 never. Hate politics, hate it all. Somebody else asked me that question. I said, you know what? If I ever ran for office, it was the shortest campaign in the history of campaigns because I would just tell the truth.
That's true.
What do you think of this?
You can't possibly win.
Next.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sadly, that's a death knell for anybody trying to be in public service, right? But yeah. You know, in your book, your most recent book, you do occasionally refer to cases that you tried or prosecuted. And so I wonder, is that another book you could do? I mean, I know you wrote a memoir that was primarily about the O.J. Simpson case, but I'd like to know more about all of the other. How many cases did you prosecute as a prosecutor?
Oh, my God, Gary.
Hundreds?
I mean, hundreds, because, you know, it's not just cases you take to trial, the cases you file, handle for a period of time, negotiate, you know, I mean, what is the number now? Some staggeringly high number of cases get resolved by way of plea bargain, which I think is a good thing, because everybody avoids the risk of what could be the biggest downside for the defendant or an acquittal that is unjust on the prosecution side. Usually plea bargaining is a good thing. And so it means you handle way more cases than you actually take to trial. And I don't even know how to encompass the number I've handled, especially at this point, having handled so many on appeal, thousands.
Did you ever think there would be at the beginning of the OJ case, did you think there might be a plea bargain there?
You know, there was a tentative feeler out about that possibility, but it wasn't real. You know, Robert Shapiro was his stock and trade. He would always deal. That's what he did. Didn't go to trial. And that's what, at that moment when he was at the helm for a very, very, very short time.
Yeah.
I thought that was a possibility, and I wasn't sure what the deal could possibly be. Two vicious murders that were premeditated. I never even got as far as thinking what the quote unquote bargain could be. So no, not really. Yeah. Not really.
So you knew that one was going to go all the way too.
It had to. It really had to. I didn't think that Shapiro would be in the case all the way. And in fact, he really wasn't. He sat at the counsel table, but it was Johnny's case.
Right. But I'm sure you have millions of other, or thousands, hundreds, lots of other stories that you could tell. Is that a possible book, future book?
I had never thought of it until you just said that.
Okay.
So I'm going to credit you. Credit you if I do it, if I ever do it. I mean, well, I'd have to think about how interesting they are in terms of how the public would feel about them. So.
Oh, well, I mean,
how much.
The thing that I was saying earlier that I think people who read Trial by Ambush would enjoy is that you're there, you know, it's you telling the story. So therefore it's interesting, because you're a great writer and a great personality that comes through. And that's what I love about your books. And I think that's true in Rachel Knight and Samantha Brickman stories too. You know, it's you telling it, and that's what makes it so much fun. So I think, yes,
thank you, Gary.
What is next? You must have something you're writing, because now you're a writer. So you're always thinking of your next book, right?
Yeah, I am. I'm kind of thinking about another true crime book, because I started rereading In Cold Blood.
Mm.
I hadn't, you know, it's been decades since I read that book.
Creative nonfiction books of all time.
Exactly. And I thought, boy, I'd like to do something in that format, in that way.
Yeah.
I don't know if I got the chops. I'm going to find out. I think I'm going to find out, because it's the next Crucible. Onward I go.
Yeah.
And I've also just put out a podcast about Crazy for Wondery called Informants Lawyer X. Lawyer X is Nicola Gabo, a very high power criminal defense attorney in Australia, in Melbourne, who was handling all the big drug lords and all the big, they were, the drug lords were also the big murderers, and bodies were literally dropping in the late 90s, early aughts, due to the drug trade, ecstasy, meth, that kind of thing. And the police were desperate to shut it down. Melbourne is a beautiful cultured city. This does not happen there. And although she was one of the most preeminent lawyers in Melbourne circles, she became the biggest police informant they ever had and turned on her own clients. And the story is incredible. The twists and turns are unbelievable. That, you know, this is a story that has to be told. So there's a limited series podcast out right now called Informants Lawyer X on Wondery.
Good. All right. Well, I want to listen to that. That's going on my phone right away.
I think you'll like it, Gary. I think you'll have fun.
I can't wait. And what about TV? I mean, I know that some of the novels that you wrote were optioned. What's the progress? What's going on?
I'm not actively looking at that right now. Though, you know, that really is never say never. If an opportunity came along to do something quality with especially Rachel Knight or Samantha Brinkman, that would be fun. Or even Trial by Ambush to do either a documentary or a film or a limited series. That would be a cool thing to do. I can imagine. I start casting in my mind. Who's
Sarah
gonna play
Paulson
Barbara?
As Barbara Graham.
Yeah.
She can play anybody. Wonderful. She can play anybody.
She can. Isn't that true?
Yeah.
Really?
That must have been a great moment for you when she won her Emmy Award and she pointed to you and there you were. That must have been exciting.
It was. I was so proud of her and so happy for her. I think she's always been such a talent, you know, and I was very miserable when I heard they were going to do the O.J. Simpson trial. And I initially thought when I heard that they were going to do that, oh, no one's going to watch that. No one. Oh, man, I've been there, done that. It's old news. And so, Gary, if you ever want to know what show is going to be a hit, don't ask me. So I'm really not the one.
Yeah.
But she was quite wonderful. And I was really happy that she was justly rewarded for being the amazing talent that she is.
Well, I can see how, from your point of view, I mean, that story could have been told in a different way that would have been a lot less interesting and a lot less your story. I mean, they really took your point of view, which is that is the truth, not alternative truth or alternative facts.
It's alternative facts.
Well, that must have been gratifying for you.
Yeah. Yeah. It turned out to be, you know, a pretty good thing. I hope people felt like they learned something about the criminal justice system, about how that trial went, about the pressures that were brought to bear and all of the ways in which the case got affected and impacted by things that had nothing to do with it. The evidence, you know, I hope that people got that.
Well, I did. And I thought it was a great series, but of course I already knew because I had read your first book, which is a great one. All of her books are great, people. You should read Marcia Clark. She's entertaining and delightful and wonderful. And her new book, which is a true crime book, but nevertheless entertaining and fascinating. It's called Trial by Ambush, Murder, Injustice, and the Truth About the Case of Barbara Graham. And Marcia Clark, thank you so much for coming back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Gary. It's a pleasure, as always, you know. And this time I actually got to see you, and that nice. Is even better.
Joining me now is Lissa Warren. She is the founder and president of Lissa Warren PR, a company that specializes in book and author publicity. She's a professor at Emerson College, and she joins me here on From the Bookshelf occasionally. Lissa, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Gary.
What have you been reading, Lissa?
I've been reading Naked City by Eric Drucker. It is a graphic novel, so it does have text, but it has a lot of illustrations. So it's a quick read in that way. In this long-awaited graphic novel from esteemed illustrator and storyteller Eric Drucker, three bohemians, a painter, a street dancer, and an aspiring musician, struggle to answer the question, is it possible for an artist to survive in the 21st century? Devoid of family, a young singer hitchhikes her way to Manhattan. And when she gets there, she befriends a street dancer she meets while busking. And desperate for rent, she poses for a painter who has shifted from landscapes to nudes. The relationships lead the three of them, all three of them, to ponder the purpose of art and the meaning of success. Naked City takes us inside the head of artists and the native New Yorker Eric Drucker, whose award-winning graphic novels, beginning with a book called Flood, have charted really new terrain in the form. Like he is one of the old guard when it comes to graphic novels. He's been doing this for a long, long time and is extremely influential. And speaking of influential, he has had a lot of covers on the New Yorker magazine. So if his name is familiar to your listeners, it could be because of his previous books, but it could also be because of his New Yorker covers. He actually has the cover of New Yorker magazine right now, and that is his 40th New Yorker magazine cover. He lives in the Bay Area. He's a local guy, and he is just such a talented illustrator, but also a talented storyteller. I'm not a big graphic novel person. I've only read a few before, but I liked this a whole lot, and I was really glad that I tried something different.
Well, you know, I love comics, and I know we're supposed to call them graphic novels, but, you know, it's a comic. And
comics.
Yeah. And
book-length comics.
I love Eric Drucker, and I love his I loved Flood, which was one of his previous things. And I love his style, his faces. They're very simple, simplistic, but at the same time, he gets a lot in the simplistic drawings that he uses. They're kind of Little Orphan Annie.
Yeah, there's a lot there. There's a lot there. And in fact, I was reading a review of the book recently, and they were talking about how he uses different colors for different characters. And it's you know, a full color book, but the colors are like, you know, green and gray and kind of blue. Like they're
tinted.
Muted. They're not they're not vibrant colors. And the first time I read the book, I didn't even notice that each character got their own color. But sure enough, when I went back and looked, I was like, oh my gosh, you're right.
Yeah.
So I missed a lot because I'm not familiar with the form. You know, like there are things that I know that I'm not.
You've neglected your habits.
I'm trying.
You never read comic books when you were
really cool book.
Younger?
I would go to the comic book store with my dad. He would take me and we would get, you know, like Superman comics, like Batman, like the old school stuff. And that was when I was, you know, 5 years old, 7 years old. And really since then, I haven't had any experience with comics other than the occasional Sunday funnies where you take, what is it, the silly putty, and you press that on and it picks up the ink and then you can kind of stretch it and morph their little faces
all
that.
Yes, that's so much fun.
And then when I worked at Houghton Mifflin a few years ago, there was a graphic novel that came out that was sort of all the rage and by a woman, you know, which is unusual in this genre. But other than that, I really haven't had much exposure to graphic novels. I just haven't.
But, you
but
like,
I like them.
You like this one.
Out.
Yeah, good.
Well, yeah, I like this a lot.
Well, and it's called Naked City. And I love that.
Naked City.
I love that title because, of course, it makes you, it brings to mind the Naked City, the old television series, kind of film noirish television series about crime in New York.
Absolutely, I'm sure that was intentional.
But it's a pun in this case.
It is because she poses nude for this painter.
Yeah, very cool. Naked City by Eric Drucker, who also is an illustrator for New Yorker magazine. Thank you, Lissa Warren, for talking to us about it on From the Bookshelf.
My pleasure.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.